The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. My guest today is Alice J. Friedman. She's the author of When Trucks Stop Running, Energy and the Future of Transportation, published by Springer Books. She's also the creator of the Energy Skeptic website. That's energyskeptic.com. Very worthwhile checking in there. A lot of interesting stuff there. Ms. Friedman is perhaps best known for her book Peak Soil from 2007, which was edited by David Pimentel from Cornell University with Tad Padsick from UC Berkeley and Walter Youngquist, the author of Geodestinies. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's a pleasure to have her on the KunstlerCast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can become a patron of this show by making a small monthly contribution through my Patreon page. To do that, you can either search for me on patreon.com, that's patreon.com, or use the link in the upper right-hand corner of my website, kunstler.com. So I'm speaking to Alice Friedman in Oakland, California. And we're going to be talking about oil and trucking and transportation generally and the fate of Western civilization or perhaps all of the developed world. And Alice, I'm wondering if what your view is of the disarray in the global economy right now. We're talking about 3 or 4 days after the Brexit vote, and markets are wobbling. There's a lot of political instability out there, especially in Great Britain. But I wonder how much you view all of these problems as an expression of more of our deep problem with resources, and especially with energy resources.
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that oil peaked, conventional oil, which is where 90% comes from, peaked in 2005, and we have reached the end of growth, and the financial system was never built to handle that. It's built on endless growth and more credit and debt repaid. And I think it's almost entirely due to energy, which is the true driver of our economy.
It seems to me to be very peculiar that the leaders of the great nations of the world, who are not necessarily stupid people, don't understand what an anomalous period of history the last 200 odd years have been, these years of the techno-industrial society. Do you find that curious?
I do, but it's interesting. I'm such a geek. I actually enjoy reading the House and Senate congressional record, and especially the people that are in the military who testify are super aware of this issue. Mm-hmm. And Michael Breen of the Truman National Security Project in 2012 pretty much said why we're doomed to continue fighting wars in the Middle East. We're so dependent on oil as our only transportation fuel, and our military cannot operate with oil. And that lack of alternatives means that oil is not just a commodity. It is a vital strategic commodity, a substance without our which our prosperity cannot be sustained. We have no choice but to do whatever it takes in order to obtain a sufficient supply of oil. We share that sad and dangerous predicament with virtually every other nation on earth. Mm-hmm. So to me, that signals we're never going to get out of the Middle East. We can't. Our civilization would die.
And it would imply to me that we're never going to be able to face politically the consequences of a no-growth society.
It looks that way. President Carter was once invited to speak about in 2009 about how he handled the energy crisis. And he said the number one thing that has to happen is for the president to have fireside chats like I did and educate the people.
Mm-hmm.
But well, I've seen, you know, they won't get reelected if they do that. They're not going to do that.
Well, that seems to have been the lesson for Carter, although I'm not sure that, you know, we're drawing the right conclusion from that. He was one guy, and that was one time, and he was a certain personality. I do tend to think that the leadership is probably going to have to, you know, surrender to some kind of a revolutionary movement of some kind. And by that, I don't necessarily mean a bloody upheaval, but some kind of major change in the personnel. I guess you might call that the circulation of elites, you know, where one set of elites just gets shoved out and a new set of elites gets installed who have a different worldview.
Yeah, I don't see. I always wonder when the crunch hits how they're going to handle it. I'm not quite sure myself.
Well, in any case, you're the author of the new book, which is titled When the Trucks Stop Running. And the trucks really make the world go around, don't they? Especially the USA. And we have more roads than railroad tracks or rivers or seacoast or canals or any other way of moving things around. We've kind of gotten in the habit of depending on these things, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real important point to make because, you know, ships can be 600 times more energy efficient than airplanes and, you know, considerably more than trucks or rail. But we only have 25,000 miles of waterways, and rail is four times more efficient than trucks, but we only have 95,000 miles of railroad tracks, but we've got 4 million miles of roads. And yeah. I'm not, you know, and when you think about trucks, it's not just 18-wheelers and delivery vans. You've got tractors, harvesters, cranes, garbage, bulldozer, concrete, construction, logging, mining, dump, chemical tank trucks. They are the true maintainers of civilization as we know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the trucks stop, America stops. How does that work?
Well, there have actually been little experiments, like when the British lorry strikers didn't run for a week. And Sweden and America have also done studies on what would happen. The list is too long to go into, but just here's a quick overview. At the end of day one, grocery stores would be out of eggs, milk, bread, and many other products because they get many deliveries a day, and so do hospitals, pharmacies, factories, and other businesses. By the end of day two, panic and hoarding would have emptied most grocery store shelves.
Yikes.
Restaurants and pharmacies would close. ATMs would be out of cash. Construction would stop. By the end of day three, sewage treatment, sludge, and slime tanks would be full. By the end of day four, most service stations would be closed because they get deliveries two or three times a week. And the 685,000 tons of trash we throw out every day would really begin to pile up. By day five, livestock would be getting hungry from lack of feed deliveries. By 2 weeks, no clean water would exist because the chemicals to purify it couldn't be delivered, and everyone would need to boil their water. Within 4 weeks, hospitals would be out of most things. And with 1 to 2 months, the coal stockpiles at power plants would run out due to lack of coal deliveries, and you'd start to have blackouts across the most coal-dependent regions. And since electricity is used to pump natural gas through pipelines, in many areas, you'd start to have blackouts from natural gas pipelines being unable to deliver electricity to power plants.
Hmm. Somewhere in there, the nuclear plants go south.
Yeah, that's a pretty serious thing to happen. The latest National Research Council report on Fukushima found that if the electricity had been out much longer, the spent nuclear fuel pool at Fukushima, which isn't in the containment area, could have made Tokyo evacuated.
Oh, my gosh.
And that can certainly happen in the U.S., where we don't have nuclear waste storage. And the potential for in just one nuclear facility, Peach Bottom, an MIT study found 18 million people might need to be evacuated.
What region is that?
Pennsylvania.
Oh, my gosh.
Near Philadelphia.
Well, we've really ramped up an incredibly complex system, and we've never really experienced a major disruption of it. Going back to the OPEC oil embargo of 73 and 74, that was a kind of a partial interruption, but not complete. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, I was in college back then. Uh-huh. And I had joined an alternate technology group. I was really interested in this. I watched the engineers build electric cars, methane cars, windmills, and I got to help in the endeavor by drinking a lot of beer and painting the cans black to make a primitive solar collector. So I thought the world's problems would be solved easily, and it would be a big party.
Huh. Well, we're going to talk about alternative energy later on, but I want to get a few other things out of the way. A lot of people think that the peak oil problem just magically went away, right? It's been kind of an era of wishful thinking since the big scares of 2008, you know, when the oil went up to $140 a barrel and the global markets crashed. And then we got the so-called fracking miracle. We were going to turn into Saudi America. Where are we at with peak oil?
Well, the conventional oil, as I mentioned earlier, peaked 10 years ago, and we've been on a plateau since then. The problem is we get well over half of it from only 500 giant oil fields, and over half of them are declining at 6% a year, which will keep accelerating. So by 2030, a huge amount of our oil, both these giant fields and other, will be declining at 9% a year. We could only have half as much oil only 14 years from now because of that. And it will be very hard to replace with tar sands, fracked, or Arctic oil.
What is the nature of this non-conventional oil, and what makes it not a magical answer to our problem?
Well, the problem is the rate of the flow. It's as if you squeeze Niagara Falls into just a trickle. You know, yes, there's still a lot of water, but it doesn't come out as fast as you'd like. And so you just cannot get tar sands out, and you have to use so much energy to get them, and fracked oil for that matter, and Arctic oil we don't even know how to get. And deep sea oil, all of that takes such amount of energy that you have less to return to society. Conventional oil, you used to stick the drill in and it gushed out like spindle top. That easy oil, we don't have much left of. So even if oil lasts another several thousand years, it will just be, you know, a drip out of the tap at night that keeps you awake instead of the roar of Niagara Falls that we have now.
Well, of course, what's faking people out is the fact that the market price of oil got so low. It fell to so low, you know, to something like $26 a barrel. In the last 6 months, it's gone a little bit higher since then, but now it seems to be falling once again, and that has faked them out. And I don't know if the public understands that the market price of the oil might be $26, but it still costs, you know, $75 a barrel to get it out of the ground. So that's really not penciling out very well, is it?
No, and in fact, you know, we had 30 years of no CAFE standards. And we finally got them again. But every time the price gas goes down, Americans go back to buying gas guzzlers again.
Tell the listeners what CAFE standards are exactly.
Well, when Jimmy Carter came into office, cars were only getting 12 miles a gallon on average. And he managed to increase that to 27. miles per gallon by the end of his term, but then Reagan dropped them. And the Democrats have never been able to get them back until Obama did. And so, the goal was to increase miles per gallon to 54. But as soon as gas prices dropped, the incremental achievement we'd made from 22 miles a gallon to 25 has gone back down again. And just today in the New York Times, it said that people are trading in their electric vehicles for gas-guzzling cars.
Huh. Are they dissatisfied with them or what?
Well, gas is so cheap. It's so convenient. They perceive it as saving money because they don't have long-term memories or a true understanding of how finite oil is, apparently.
Mm-hmm. I've got some ideas about why the price of oil went down so low, and so do a lot of the other people I speak with here. But what's your idea of why the price of oil has gone down so low, even though it costs so much to get it out of the ground?
Well, you've had a forced reduction in demand, for one thing. I know people who haven't recovered from the financial crash. Time magazine had an article recently saying that 2/3 of Americans would have a hard time getting their hands on $1,000. Those people certainly aren't going to be buying electric cars or better mileage gas cars. I just don't think people can afford oil at a higher price.
Well, we do know that the middle class is getting crushed, and that might have a great deal to do with the demand destruction. But it's also coming from the industrial economy, too, is it not?
Oh, yeah. And Charles Hall has written about how we're doomed to an eternal cycle of prices for oil ratcheting up, which brings on a recession or depression, which drops them again. And then when you get a recovery and the prices go up, you're knocked down again.
Yeah, I think it can be boiled down to a pretty simple equation for the moment, that oil over $75 a barrel crushes economies, and oil under $75 a barrel crushes oil companies.
Yeah, and people who have been working in peak oil economic theory have predicted for decades that a sign of it would be these spikes of high prices, low prices, high prices, low prices, and it looks like their predictions are coming true.
So it's kind of an oscillation, like what you would see in like riding a motorcycle in a speed wobble.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dynamic that is a self-reinforcing dynamic.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's talk about diesel. Diesel is what most of the industrial trucking machines run on, whether they're harvesters, semi-trailers, cherry pickers, what have you. What's so special about diesel?
Well, Vaclav Smil would say it was the diesel engine because he doesn't believe we could have possibly achieved as high a level of civilization as we have without them, and that they're vastly underappreciated. And he has a book on them, which is interesting to read, to see how amazingly, exquisitely crafted they are, how powerful, how well-built. They can last 40 years, go a million miles, double the efficiency of a gasoline engine.
Why are they so durable, by the way?
They have to be built extremely well to tolerate the powerful forces of the engine itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to craft it to deal with getting double the power out of it. But the problem with them is they don't burn anything else. That's why you don't hear about dieselhol. They can't even burn gasoline. In fact, they have to burn number 2 diesel, which has extremely specific recipes for how much viscosity, lubricity, water content, flash point, and so on, which makes it hard to, more energy to replace it to try to meet those specifications.
Mm-hmm.
And biodiesel in particular has a hard time meeting all of those different essential qualities so that you don't shorten the engine life. And that's why most engine warranties don't allow any biodiesel, or at most 5 to 20% or you invalidate your warranty on your engine. And truckers don't want biodiesel because they don't go as far. It's 10% less energy, and it costs more.
Well, we heard a lot about biodiesel in around the 2005-2008 period. You know, there were all these stories in the press about guys running their cars on used French fried potato oil. You don't think that that's going to pan out for trucking anyway?
No, I mean, the problem with biofuels is they simply don't scale up. You'd have to plant half of the lower 48 states with soybeans and whatnot to replace diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. Europe consumes, massive amounts of energy, hundreds of times more, the equivalent of hundreds of times more biomass than you could get out of, than less than the fuel we're burning.
I'm not sure I understand that.
Let me give a better example. Mm-hmm. Oil is a biofuel, but it took millions of years to brew, and there were 196,000 pounds of fossil plants per gallon of oil. So we're trying to put 40 acres of wheat in our gas tanks every 20 miles. And the energy to try to do that quickly is usually more energy than you get out of the fuel, or damn close. I don't want to get into a fight over energy return on energy invested, but biofuels have a very low and probably negative return on energy. And the other thing to consider is, in the future, biofuels will be the only replacements for fossil fuels.
Uh-huh.
So right now, 2/3 of our electricity is generated with coal and natural gas. That'll have to be biomass in the future. The fertilizer.
But it's not going to be. I mean, in theory, it would have to be if we were going to run our civilization the way we've been running it. But we're not going to do that.
Oh, I know. But I think that the scale is the easiest argument for people to understand why it's not going to mm-hmm. fuel transportation, because it has so many other essential uses, not just electricity, but 4 billion people are kept alive by natural gas-based fertilizers. 500,000 products are made out of fossil fuels, as well as the power to make them. You need fossil fuel power to get high enough heat to make cement, steel, ceramics, glass, and so on, provide heat, air conditioning, and cooking. Biomass can't possibly power our vehicles and do all the rest of those things. Mm-hmm. It just simply doesn't scale up.
Well, we have other fantasies about other fuels, natural gas, for example. We do know that some trucks have been converted to natural gas. Tell listeners why we're not going to run the existing trucking fleet on natural gas.
Well, I mean, our conventional natural gas peaked in 1973, and by 2004, there was such alarm about future supplies that dozens of liquefied natural gas plants were being planned for to import natural gas. This frack natural gas gave us an extra 5 or 10 years, but if the economic frack bubble hadn't burst, it would be geologically bursting between now and 2020. So that's not going to guarantee our future. And it's also, since diesel engines can't burn natural gas, it would just be really crazy hard to build enough massive heavy tanks, brand new engines, to retrofit our existing trucks and build new ones. We don't have the infrastructure to distribute it. Truckers don't like it because they can only go a quarter to half as far, depending on which kind of gas they're using, compressed or liquefied.
You mean between fill-ups?
Yeah, between fill-ups. It's but there's no infrastructure to do it.
Yeah, there's no natural gas fill-up stations.
Yeah, there's 73 liquefied natural gas stations right now, and they're almost all in California.
Right, so there's no national network of them, and you couldn't take a truck full of lettuce from Fresno to Philadelphia in a natural gas truck.
No, you couldn't. I mean, there are tanks for private fleets, but they tend to be delivery vans.
Yeah.
And private. So at this There actually was hope we'd have 20% of our fleet on natural gas by now, but it's only 3.5%.
So that hasn't panned out.
There's
another kind of wishful thought that we could do the coal to liquids thing, where you basically distill liquid fuels out of coal.
Yeah, that is one of the few ways that you could make a drop-in fuel, a diesel that is exactly what trucks burn now. Sasol in South Africa has been doing that for 50 years. But again, coal does not scale up. I mean, that will shock people.
Mm-hmm.
We're past peak coal in America. We're probably past it globally or close to it. Again, look at the scale. If all coal production were converted to liquefied coal, you'd only get a fifth of what you need, and you'd have to shut down all your electric power plants and so on.
That doesn't seem like a very good prospect.
It's because you'd have to use half the energy in the coal to make the liquefied coal. And if you try to sequester the carbon, another 40%. Mm-hmm. And it also, coal to liquids requires a lot of water. And yet most of the reserves in America are in the dry states of Wyoming and Montana.
Mm-hmm.
So there's other limits. There's limits to water, especially.
Another fantasy out there was that we were going to convert the entire vehicle fleet to electric. And I want to talk about cars for a second rather than trucks. It seems to me that the what I call the happy motoring paradigm is failing on the basis of something other than fuel right now, and in a kind of way that wasn't quite expected. And by that I mean the financial part of the equation is falling apart, because Americans are used to buying their cars on installment loans, and that middle class that used to do that is shrinking and getting crushed financially. You know, as you said a few minutes ago, there are very few households in this country that even have $1,000 extra dollars in the bank to fix a car, let alone make a down payment on one. I also think that because of we've entered a kind of a no-growth contracting economy, that pretty much tells you that we're going to be living in an era of capital formation impairment, and that there will be less money available to fewer qualified buyers for car loans. So I see the motoring system just really crapping out on the basis of the finance before we even get to the fuel situation.
That could be true, but if you look at Cuba, you could keep the old vehicles going for quite some time, as long as they have fuel, that is.
Well, yeah, as long as they have fuel. And I think what people forget about Cuba is that, you know, people point to Cuba as being this example of a country that got over its subsidies from Russia or the Soviet Union and managed to kind of downscale into a more utopian, green, eco-nirvana. But what they forget is a couple of things. One is, during this whole period, Cuba was getting remittances in large amounts of money from people outside Cuba who, you know, for one reason or another had left, especially all those people in Florida. So they were getting money from outside the system. They were also doing that against the background of a world that was still largely intact with all of its, you know, techno-industrial equipment running and its financial system running. You know, I'm not sure that we get to a place where if the financial system is not running, then anything runs.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what's really makes our system so vulnerable is everything's interdependent with each other. You know, it's not just energy and electricity that are intertwined. So that if the electric grid goes down, you can't pump fuel because it's electric.
Mm-hmm.
But the financial system as well, you know, is intertwined with all in that, and makes us very vulnerable.
And these failures of one part of a system tend to ramify and amplify the failures in other parts of the system, do they not?
Oh, absolutely.
So let's talk about the electric. What's your view of whether we're going to electrify the vehicle system in the USA?
Okay, well, I think, you know, a lot of hope rests on batteries. But we've been hoping since 215 years ago for battery breakthroughs. And they're only about six times more powerful now than they were centuries ago. Even in 1901, they were hoping for a breakthrough so that cars could run on batteries. But the problem is, you have to, they can never even come close to oil in power density. And there's too many damn things that are required. And when you tweak one, you might break another, and it could take you years to find out. For instance, they have to be small and lightweight, because the heavier a battery is, the less far the vehicle can go. You have to be able to recharge it thousands of times. For trucks, it would need to last for 15 years. You have to charge them fast. Right now, truck batteries are so large, it takes over 12 hours. You can't harm them by over or under charging or discharging. It has to be able to tolerate heat, cold, shaking, rattling, not explode, dozens of parameters. And that's why it takes so long to make any progress. It can take 10 years to improve a battery, because you have to retest it. And Tesla doesn't have a better battery. They invented a better battery management system to monitor the batteries and keep them from getting too hot or cold. But they suck up half the energy doing that. So every time you do make an improvement, a lot of the battery management system sucks it up, and it makes the car super heavy as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, right now there's no way that you could get trucks to run on batteries. They're just simply too heavy. Like a truck that could go 620 miles with all of the cargo loaded would need a battery weighing 55,000 pounds. I mean, the truck's not going anywhere with a battery that heavy.
So the battery would be the whole load of the truck.
Yeah, the battery would be the load. And then I have in my book several instances of that showing that, you know, no, that's not going to happen.
So the amazing thing about diesel is that you get this very concentrated amount of propulsion from a relatively small weight of stuff, and it allows you to carry huge amounts of cargo on this vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, batteries can be hundreds to thousands of times less powerful pound for pound. I mean, the energy density of diesel is amazing, and it's one of the reasons people don't understand why it's so hard to replace. It's mm-hmm. just crazy energy dense. Also, all battery electric trucks are three times more than a diesel equivalent, and so you know, an all electric truck might cost $300,000, but you could buy a used one for $3,000. So it's really 100 times more expensive.
Well, we're agonizing over the system that we use to run trucks. But let's talk about the railroads for a minute. You know, one of the things that puzzles me over the years is that we have done absolutely nothing to fix the railroad system in the USA, but especially the passenger system. And you know, we have all this infrastructure lying out there rusting in the rain, and there's no political will or no clamor from the public itself, from the voters, to do anything about it.
Well, I'm mostly concerned with freight rail, because mm-hmm. technically people don't have to travel if things got rough, but the freight trains need to keep moving. It would make no sense we have the best freight trains in the world, but they're privately owned. They're the only form of transport that gets no public funding. Mm-hmm. Trucks are subsidized by you know, our taxes we pay when we buy gasoline, mm-hmm. and the damage they do to the roads isn't nearly compensated for in the fees they pay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to improve freight rail, because they plow back a huge percent of their earnings back into maintaining what they have. And it would make no sense to electrify them because diesel electric locomotives are already electric. They simply have the power station on board instead of in some distant place with hundreds of miles of electric lines running to the rail tracks. And their engines can be more efficient than a power plant as well. In fact, overall, diesel electric is 7% more energy efficient than 100% electric locomotive.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that the locomotive actually runs on electricity, but the electricity is coming from a diesel generator on board.
That's right. And so why would you want to build 240 more power plants to supply trains with the electricity they need over tens of thousands of miles of electric wires and substations,
right,
when they're already electric?
Well, as a logistical... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to add electric mainly for passenger rail that stop and start, accelerate and go high speeds.
Mm-hmm.
Freight is the opposite. They try to never stop. If they don't have to, they very slowly accelerate and they go very low speeds to reduce the aerodynamic drag.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about the logistics, because if you only go back 100 years in American history, we actually had a system where rail and water transport pretty much worked to move an awful lot of stuff around the United States, even when the 48 states were all completed and we were a continental nation. We were, in 1916, we were moving huge quantities of stuff around. It's really a matter of sort of the end of the journey, right? The last stage of the journey.
Yeah, well, I mean, trucks move almost anything going less than 500 miles because it's convenient. You go door to door, and our economy is built on just-in-time, which is one of the greatest wastes of fuel in history, because these trucks are showing up half empty, just containing what's needed, and returning empty.
Uh-huh.
So and
they're deadheading all over America.
Yeah. And so they're wasting enormous amounts of fuel. They're already inefficient compared to rail and ships. But we don't have any policies. I have read hundreds and hundreds of transportation documents, and they're all planning for endless growth. How are we going to get more trucks on the road?
Mm-hmm.
If they're paying any attention to energy at all, it's reducing greenhouse gases, not energy efficiency. So we've never focused on that.
But is it feasible that we could go back to a system where we weren't using so many trucks for so many trips of that kind, so that we were depending more on water and rail transport? We did do it before. We did it for the years between the Civil War and the end of the First World War. Could we get back to that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we used to have four times more rail than we have now, and I don't know if the right-of-ways are gone.
Have we lost that much? That's amazing.
Yeah, we used to have 320,000 miles of rail in the States. But if the right-of-ways are gone, and, they need 1% grades, you can't put railroads just anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We could certainly try to use ships more, but we've let our marine infrastructure fall apart. The locks and levees and so on the inland waterways are really in bad shape.
Well, that's not true here. I live right next to the Champlain and Erie canals. The Champlain canal is four miles away, and the Erie canal is about 20 miles away. They kind of diverge. The Champlain goes north, the Erie goes west. But the state of New York has kept them in immaculate condition.
Oh, you're lucky. Mississippi River and Missouri and other places aren't so... Have that infrastructure maintained.
In your view, we can't get back to that system where, the bulk of the journey of the goods is done on rail and water, and only the last increment is done in some kind of a truck.
I don't think so, because, until oil came along, everybody lived near the coast. Everybody. Very few people inland. And then rail allowed people to move inland. But then trucks with 4 million miles of roads just in the United States, you could live anywhere. Now you've got 80% of communities completely dependent on trucks for everything. They don't have a port and they don't have rail.
Do you think there are parts of the United States that are going to be depopulated?
Yeah, I mean, the problem, you know, is that you've got 80% of people living within 200 miles of the coast, but 80% of food calories are grown inland. And that doesn't add up when you're trying to think about oil reaching some low enough level that it's hard to distribute food.
Yeah,
I think the Southwest, you know, there's certain areas of the country that absolutely are unsustainable and will be the first ones where you see mass migrations.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about what you're saying about the food production in the Midwest, because isn't that calculated right now on the basis of the industrial farming system that we use, of agribiz? And if we stop doing that and food has to be grown differently, what is that? Does that change the equation?
Oh, I think we've become so reliant on fertilizers and pesticides, which are gas and oil-based respectively. But the worst thing we've done is let our topsoil, which is our true wealth, degrade. It used to take civilizations an average of 1,500 years to farm their soil so much that it washed away. Now, we've in 100 years, in Iowa, where the best topsoil exists, we've let it go from 18 inches to 9 inches, and you need 6 inches to grow food. So we're, you know, there's a lot of other limiting factors besides oil that are creeping up on us.
Well, it also would seem that because of the limits of oil and really of petrochemicals and any kind of petroleum commodities, that we're not going to be able to carry on industrial agriculture whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I agree. It's a convergence of many, many forces, but I think that without transportation, you don't have anything else. You can't even deliver the 8,000 windmill parts to the turbine factory and then move the turbine somewhere. Mm-hmm. Transportation is the number one issue that needs to be solved. And if you don't define the problem correctly, you can't define the solutions correctly.
Well, I must say I'm of the opinion that we're not going to solve this problem in the way that most people fantasize. That is, solve it in a way that allows us to continue running the kind of techno-industrial society that we have. I mean, if nothing, you've said in your book that the territory of the United States can probably only feasibly support a population of about 100 million people, and that's about a third of what we have now.
Yeah, that's what Professor David Pimentel said at Cornell. There's other estimates close to that. And I also don't see how we can have an 80% to 100% renewable electric grid. I spent a lot of time on that in my book, as well as energy storage.
Let's talk about those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the electric grid, because, you know, electricity is kind of the foundational element of civilization. And, of course, we take it for granted. There are very few people who walk into a room and reach for the light switch and are surprised when the lights come on, right?
Yeah.
So that's our baseline normal. But the challenges of keeping the grid going are really pretty stiff and difficult. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you've got 2/3 of it powered by fossil fuels and 20% by nuclear. And yet the nuclear plants are almost all at the end of their lifespans. Half of them are likely to close because the post-Fukushima retrofits are too expensive. They're unreliable. And new ones aren't getting built because you can build a natural gas plant for a quarter of the cost in a tenth of the time. There's no way to raise capital to build new ones, and nor can you build them in many states because there's no nuclear waste storage. So nuclear is not going to be powering us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's not going to be natural gas because, as we discussed, it's finite. It's not going to be coal because that, too, is finite. It's not going to be hydropower because there's nowhere left to put dams to, you know, that would provide much more power. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be geothermal because that's built out and the remaining sites are way too small or too far from the grid. It's not going to be biomass, as we just discussed. It's not going to be hydrogen fusion, breeder fission, wave, tidal, ocean current, or methane hydrates because these are far from being commercial. So that means wind and gas must save the day. It's all up to them to do that. And the problem with that is they just add to the blaze. They do not replace fossil fuel and nuclear plants.
Excuse me, but did you say wind and gas? Did you mean wind and solar?
I meant wind and solar. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I meant wind and solar. And they need to be balanced by natural gas or energy storage because mm-hmm. coal and nuclear can't ramp up and down. It takes them hours.
Mm-hmm.
So
you just can't start and stop the power plant on a dime.
No, you can't. There's only and hydro can help, but a lot of times there's a drought or agriculture needs it. There's only a few ways to try to balance the wind and solar power. And then wind and solar power is far more seasonal than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you had a national grid, which isn't likely, but I don't want to go into that, there wouldn't be enough solar power in the winter for the Southwest to share with everyone. And the same with wind. In the summer, the U.S. is practically a wind desert everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And the Southeast is always a wind desert. It just doesn't get much wind. It doesn't mm-hmm. have commercial scale wind. So even if you have to have energy storage if you want the grid up. And we're far from being able to do that.
What have we got?
And how has
it improved over the years?
Well, we don't have energy storage. We have pumped hydropower, which uses more energy than it returns. And that's where you pump water up to a reservoir above an existing hydropower dam when there's low demand and then release it when there's high demand. We only have, I don't know, something like 43 of them. But we'd need 7,800 more to provide just one day of U.S. energy storage. And there have only been two built since 1995 because there's nowhere left to put them.
Mm-hmm.
We only have one compressed air energy storage plant in the United States, and those can only go in salt domes, which are nearly all in just three states along the Gulf. And we'd need almost 4,000 more of them.
What is a salt dome? Tell the listeners.
Well, a salt dome is a kind of, it's a geology where you have these walls of salt which heal if a hole were to get into it. It seals it over. They're deep under the earth so that the air doesn't leak out when you pump it in, and you can pump it in over and over. We don't have any in aquifers, abandoned rock mines, and other underground caverns because it's very unlikely that the air would be trapped down there. It would find a way to leak out.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just put those anywhere, and we only have one, and they're very expensive. The other possibility is concentrated solar power with thermal storage. Those can only be built in the Southwest because there can be no humidity. It has to be extremely dry
mm-hmm.
and no pollution. And that's why 2/3 of the ones we have are in California and 1/4 in Arizona. And they cost almost as much as nuclear power plants, which is another reason that they only generate less than 6/100 of our energy supply now.
And if we were to do that big time in the future, like people have fantasies about, you know, putting mirrors all over the Sonora Desert, the electricity you produce would have to make a very long journey to the places where it's needed.
Right, and we don't have the transmission lines, and states don't like them to cross there are state lines. They want to keep whatever power they have within the state. And you'd need, well over 8,000 more of these $1 billion per plant each. A lot of our solar farms, concentrated solar power, are only mirrors. They're not storing any electricity
mm-hmm.
at all.
They're just heating it, heating the some element that is making it, a turbine turnaround or something?
Yeah, so they and solar photovoltaic without storage are providing massive amounts of power at noon when it's not needed. Mm-hmm. It's the peak periods when people get up in the morning and go to work and return from work that you need power. So solar without energy storage is pretty worthless,
mm-hmm.
In terms of doing much of anything. So that means that you have to hope for a utility-scale electrochemical batteries to solve energy storage. None of them are commercial now, and only a few might be within 10 years. One of them is advanced lead acid, but that takes 5 times longer to recharge as discharge, so that's not in the running. Lithium ion would deplete all known resources. I didn't say reserves, I said resources of lithium. And they're also limited by how many times they can charge and discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sodium sulfur is one of the few that literally has enough material elements on Earth to actually be built. And 1 day of energy storage would require a 923 square mile sodium sulfur battery.
Mm. Well, that ain't going to happen.
No, and it's like $41 trillion. And weighs 450 million tons.
It would make the Earth wobble.
Yeah. Well, and lithium ion and lead acid aren't any better than that in terms of square miles cost and tonnage, hardly. So, you know, that's just not going to happen.
Well, the picture that you're painting is one that sort of tells me that techno-industrial civilization has its limits, too. And we may be not that far away from the ultimate limit of it.
Right, exactly. And it may be, I mean, I'm pretty much making the point that we're probably going back to the age of wood, and we ought to be preparing for that. And, you know, if some miracle happens meanwhile, we'll all party, but a prudent, rational person, based on the evidence, would be preparing to go back to the past.
Well, that's the reason that I wrote my World Made by Hand novels. A lot of people don't believe that that's where we're heading. I have been reading up on Japan a lot this year, especially Morris Berman's wonderful book, Neurotic Beauty. It seems to me that Japan is probably a good candidate for the first advanced society to go medieval.
Oh, interesting.
They've had a very unusual historical experience, and probably, you know, their most successful era was that era between about 1600 and 1850, when, I guess it's called the Edo period, when Tokyo grew to be a fairly large city, but one that was managed exquisitely ecologically. You know, they had tremendous systems for getting water to all the neighborhoods and for removing all the wastes, and they didn't use fossil fuels, and, you know, they developed a very high culture of tremendous artistry, and they had a pretty good system going until Commodore Perry landed in Tokyo Bay. I think the journey back in America would probably be pretty rough. What does your imagination tell you about how we're going to get back to that earlier level, or let's say a reset of the human project?
Well, I don't see how it can go well, because we're the most dependent of any society on Earth on oil. I don't know. One thing we could do, Isaac Asimov in 1974 said the only thing that we could do is to try to keep our birth rate down, which means giving women interesting things to do, running the government, science, industry. He said that would be a kind of a woman's lib world. So either we lower population or humanely, or we just let Mother Nature do it. And he said, and I have a suspicion that we won't make the right choice, which is the tragedy of humanity right now. I've been shrewd enough to be born in 1920, which means I'll be safely dead before the crunch comes.
That's not you, that's Asimov.
That's Asimov, but you guys will see for yourself. I hope you see a world in which mankind has decided to be sane. But I must say, in all honesty, that I figure that the chances are against it. So that was his take on what to do and what lay ahead.
Well, I'm
back in 1974.
I'm going to kind of force the issue with you because I asked you what was going on in your imagination. What does your imagination tell you about that journey back? And you didn't quite lay it out.
I read a lot about fallen societies elsewhere, North Korea, war-torn societies in Africa. I don't think it's any different than that. I think you're going to see, you're only 9 meals away from a revolution, a famous thing. So mm-hmm. you're going to see more. I think that the politics now is a sign of what's to come, where you have Trump running and increasing hatred and racism and people forming coalitions of their own little groups, whatever those turn out to be. And that's something that fascinates me, but I don't know how the groupings will happen. I don't know how much the government at local, state, or federal levels will try to restrict people from migrating and leave some areas that are the worst as is so they don't topple the lifeboats of other areas. Like, will they prevent people in Arizona from coming to the Central Valley? That intrigues me, and I'm sure that Homeland Security has some idea of what the plans are, but that's being kept classified information from the public.
Yeah, I think when people get away from home, it gets a lot harder to survive. You know, you get rained on 2 or 3 times, and you get pretty sick. I hear a lot of fantasies around here in upstate New York. People are afraid that, if the economy really went south in the big way, if there was an EMP attack or something, an electromagnetic pulse attack on our electric grid, for example, that the hordes of looting New Yorkers would come up here 200 miles to upstate New York. And I actually don't think that 99.9% of them would even make it.
Yeah, but the young people can get pretty far on a bicycle. I agree with you that a lot of people will just remain where they are, hoping things will get better. A pandemic is possible too, and in the 1918 flu, only 2% of Americans died. I know that sounds like a lot, but they think half of people in India or other countries where malnutrition and hunger reign. Makes you more vulnerable to disease. So I think that could also play a role in population decline here. It frustrates me because one of the reasons I've written about all this is to try to get friends, family, enlightened people to steer their children away from becoming lawyers and more towards farming or agriculture or, professions that'll be meaningful in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've changed very many people's lives. It's just too hard to contemplate a different future or imagine it.
Well, we speak about all of these rescue remedies for our energy problem. And, at the end of the day, it all kind of ends up seeming like an exercise in futility. We're not going to get to that alt energy nirvana that we're wishing for. We really have to make other arrangements.
No, we ought to be building passive solar homes out of empty beer cans. There's so many things we could do with the energy we have left, and we're just spending it in one last party.
Yeah. Driving to Walmart and vacationing in Orlando.
Yeah, I think our descendants will be furious that we spent our oil driving around alone in 4,000-pound cars and just, blew the fuel out without thinking of the future.
Yeah. Well, Alice, do we have any, can we shed any light and cheer on the situation as we sign off?
I think it's important for people to understand our situation because then you appreciate what you have, and that's made me much more satisfied with my life and not just taking it for granted, being grateful.
I think that being grateful is very important, and I agree with you. And I'm awful glad that you came by the podcast to talk to me about these things.
Well, likewise, it was fun for me, too.
Good luck there in California. California's kind of a spooky place these days, isn't it?
It's the shake-and-bake state. I'll be front row for whatever transpires.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's not that interesting, and we will ride again. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.